fact about the universe to the sum of human knowledge, he offered an astronomer's version of the mountaineers because it's there. Only after a great number of variables had been discovered, he said, and their changeable natures closely observed, could the inquiry into the causes of variability commence. As the search for new variables entered its productive second year, Pickering continued to press for physical plant improvements that would give the books and pamphlets of the library, still housed in the old wooden observatory building, the same fireproof protection now guaranteed to the glass plates. Recent efforts by the visiting committee had failed to raise sufficient funds. On March 4, 1907, as though to demonstrate the danger, fire broke out in Pickering's half-empty house. The flames threatened to engulf the director's residence and leap to the adjacent east wing of the observatory. Fortunately, the members of the observatory brigade, their skills sharpened through years of surprise practice drills, heeded the alarm signal and doused the outburst even before the municipal firefighters arrived. Mina Fleming spotted 19 new variables in 1907. She identified them the same way she always had, by the vagaries of their spectra, as opposed to hunting for them by superposing chart plates. Only later, in the wake of discovery, did she turn to the chart plates to verify her finds. Catching a star in different guises at different times, brighter here, fainter there, clinched its identity as a variable. Following the precise course of its changes over time, however, sometimes required 10 or more nearby steady lights to bear witness. Ideally, the brightest of these neighbors would shine brighter than the variable at maximum, the faintest one fainter than at minimum, and the differences between the intermediates would not exceed half a magnitude. In 1907, Mrs. Fleming published her modus operandi for choosing and evaluating such sequences of stellar standards. A photographic study of variable stars gave positions and magnitudes for the more than 3,000 stars she had corralled to track the 200-plus variables she discovered. Many astronomers are deservedly proud to have discovered one variable and content to leave the arrangements for its observation to others, commented Herbert Hall Turner, Mrs. Fleming's transatlantic colleague in the Royal Astronomical Society, in reaction to this work. The discovery of 222 and the care for their future on this scale is an achievement bordering on the marvelous. In each group of stars, Mrs. Fleming measured the variable's neighbors with a fly spanker, gave them alphabetical labels beginning with A for the brightest, and then calculated the brightness difference between A and B, B and C, and every other interval along the sequence. Then she judged the same set of stars in the same way on a second plate, a third, and a fourth. Although the pecking order of her sequences held fast, the size of the brightness intervals did not. Some of the plates had been taken with the 8-inch Draper telescope, others with the Bache. Differences between the telescopes and also between the photographic emulsions on the plates introduced inconsistencies. She got around them by averaging the four figures for each interval. These mean values gave her a set of stepping stones from one end of each sequence to the other. Assuming, for the moment, that every star labeled A equaled magnitude zero, she pegged the magnitudes of B onward by adding on the successive intervals. Next, she nudged these interim values away from the arbitrary zero starting point by correlating them to visual magnitudes. The director and his assistants, both in Cambridge and in Arequipa, had repeatedly observed many of her comparison stars and recorded their magnitudes. She pulled those numbers from published reports and paired them with hers. Subtracting the difference between the visual and the photographic for each star, she derived a mean difference for each sequence. In the final step, she added the mean difference to each star to arrive at its adopted magnitude. Mrs. Fleming identified herself on the title page of her photographic study as Curator of Astronomical Photographs. Later, on her petition for U.S. citizenship, she shortened the title to Astronomer, since the form provided only a small space for stating one's occupation. In another box, she crossed out Wife, typed Husband in its place, and put Deceased in parentheses alongside James Orr Fleming's name. As of September 9, 1907, she was officially an American. Having established and disseminated her photographic standards, Mrs. Fleming began the slow work of applying them to her 222 variables. Many of these stars appeared on 100 or more plates, and she intended to measure their magnitudes on every available image in order to ascertain all 222 light curves. Along the way, or in the future, whenever the true magnitudes of her comparison stars became known, then the light curves of her variables could be adjusted accordingly. Everything was relative in the realm of magnitude assessment. Mrs. Fleming's photographic standards hinged on Pickering's photometry, which hung in turn on decades of visual comparisons of one star to another. The great desideratum of true or absolute magnitude awaited the discovery of the distances to the stars and the dustiness of space. Distance dimmed every sort of illumination. And stardust, if such a thing indeed littered the heavens, might obstruct the flow of starlight. While Pickering praised Mrs. Fleming's photographic study as the first large collection of sequences of comparison stars for studying variables photographically, he was in the midst of honing a lone stellar sequence to serve as a universal standard. Miss Leavitt contributed mightily to this effort. One day, Pickering anticipated, the great chain of 40 or more stars constituting Harvard's North Polar sequence would underpin all photographic magnitudes. At 61, Pickering could still rely on his own keen vision for visual photometry. He was about to mount a new round of visual assessments of faint stars using his latest photometer and a 60-inch reflecting telescope acquired from the estate of the late English astronomer Andrew Ainslie Common. The director's personal equation, the way his eye connected to his brain and hands, naturally differed from the personal equations of his assistants, Wendell, Bailey, and Searle. And yet, the decades of iteration ad nauseum had brought a gratifying consistency to their results. The revised Harvard photometry, published in 1908, made this manifest. It provided cumulative data on the magnitudes of 9,000 bright stars. Pickering hoped that astronomers everywhere would respect this compendium of his efforts since 1879 as the standard reference authority in the field. In recognition of all Pickering had done to further photometry and spectroscopy, the Astronomical Society of the Pacific awarded him its 1908 Catherine Wolfe Bruce Gold Medal for Lifetime Achievement. Pickering might have felt even more pleased to see the honor bestowed on Mrs. Fleming, as he had often suggested. But her prospects of winning it seemed unlikely. The revised Harvard photometry, perused round the world, not only gathered and averaged information that had been scattered through several earlier volumes of the annals, but also included the spectral type of each of the 9,000 stars, adjudged by Miss Cannon according to the Draper classification system. This useful addition soon elicited a criticism from a young Danish astronomer, Einar Hertzsprung of Copenhagen. Hertzsprung shared Pickering's ardor for hands-on photometry. For several years, he had been trying to factor distance into the stellar magnitude equation in order to determine stars' intrinsic brightness. A number of stellar distances had been established by trigonometry for stars within 100 light years of the sun. Relative distances of the farther stars could be wrung from their incremental movements over time across the line of sight, with the very farthest ones exhibiting the least so-called proper motion. By this yardstick, Hertzsprung revealed that some of the brightest stars lay at the greatest distances from the sun. He could only imagine what blazing giants they must be to beam such inordinate luminosity from the very depths of space. In the spectra of the brightest faraway lights, Hertzsprung found very narrow, very sharply defined hydrogen lines. He recognized these traits as distinctions originally defined by Antonia Maury in describing the C division of her complex two-tiered classification system. As one of the first to see the wisdom of Miss Maury's ways, Hertzsprung rued the use of Miss Cannon's modified classification in the revised Harvard photometry. On July 22, 1908, he wrote to Pickering, complaining that the system adopted in the new volume was too simplistic. He compared it to a botanical classification based on the size and color of flowers instead of the morphology of plants. For emphasis, he reiterated the point with an animal analogy. "To neglect the C properties in classifying stellar spectra, I think, is nearly the same thing as if the zoologist, who has detected the deciding differences between a whale and a fish, would continue classifying them together." Pickering, the original publisher of Miss Maury's classification, appreciated its merits even while questioning its complexity. But Miss Maury had built her system on only a few hundred stars, and it might not hold true across tens of thousands. Likewise, the conclusions that Hertzsprung drew from her work seemed to Pickering premature. Miss Maury, who had never severed relations with Pickering, also wrote to him in mid-1908 to request another letter of reference. She was considering applying somewhere for an adjunct professorship in physics and astronomy. Without hesitation, the director again praised her painstaking investigations and important contributions. Presently, she told him she would rather resume her research than pursue teaching. He assured her the observatory door stood open, though he could not promise her a full-time wage. Miss Maury had long supplemented her income by giving freelance lectures, which she called Evenings with the Stars. Her promotional brochure boasted she had spoken at Cornell University, Wells College, the Brooklyn Institute of Arts and Sciences, the New York Academy of Science and the Museum of Natural History, and the New York City Department of Education, as well as to schools, lyceums, clubs, and parlor audiences. Her terms were $10 for a single talk, Sun, Moon, and Stars, a brief survey, and $30 for a four-part course on either the visible universe or evolution in the heavens. She illustrated the presentations with lantern slides she requested of Pickering and Mrs. Fleming, who also sent her the observatory's circulars and other publications to keep her informed of scientific news through the years while she taught literature at girls' schools in the towns near Hastings-on-Hudson. In December 1908, Miss Maury returned to the observatory as an associate researcher. She reunited with the spectroscopic binaries that had made her reputation nearly 20 years before, and also with Beta Lyrae, the mystery variable that changed its light on an irregular, inscrutable timetable. Miss Leavitt, similarly intrigued by Beta Lyrae's strange behavior, more than once opined to Miss Maury, "We shall never understand it until we find a way to send up a net and fetch the thing down." Miss Leavitt discovered another 56 new variables on the Harvard maps of the sky in 1908, maintaining her lead over Miss Cannon and Miss Leland by a wide margin. She also published her findings about the Magellanic Clouds. Through careful comparisons of many plates, she had observed the range of maximum to minimum brightness for all 1,777 of her variables, and listed these data in 12 dense pages of tables. Thus far, however, she had followed only a small number through their complete cycles of change. When she tabulated the periods alongside the magnitude ranges for these 16 stars, a pattern emerged. It is worthy of notice, she wrote in her report, that the brighter variables have the longer periods. She wondered what that might mean, and whether the trend would persist. She was continuing to analyze more periods when illness interrupted her work about 2 weeks before Christmas. From her hospital room in Boston on December 20th, she thanked Pickering for the pink roses and get-well wishes. Then she went home to Wisconsin to recuperate. The ideal weather conditions that smiled on Arequipa from May to October sometimes lasted all year long. Astronomers arriving from the north would remark on the stillness of the air that produced such optimal seeing. No radical day-to-night temperature changes unsteadied the dry atmosphere, and no pre-dawn dew accumulated on telescope lenses. Those who stayed for many months almost welcomed the interruption of the brief cloudy season, which afforded them the time to make instrument repairs or attend to other neglected business. Of late, however, the off-season had lengthened. Cloud cover now spread a pall over the telescopes for extended periods between November and April. Harvard staff members at the Boyden Station had persisted in their observations through revolutionary gunfire and local epidemics of smallpox and yellow fever. But clouds could not be endured. Pickering got busy soliciting opinions about alternate sites in South Africa. As before, in Colorado, California, and Peru, he needed someone to reconnoiter the potential locations. Once again, he chose Solon Bailey. At a farewell luncheon, President Elliott saluted Bailey as the observatory's foreign ambassador without portfolio. Fortunately, the new venture would not require the 54-year-old emissary to climb mountains or build roads. His entire African itinerary stretched across a plateau with an average elevation of 5,000 feet. Though only knee-high to the Andes, the Cape Colony's Great Karoo Plateau lay much farther south and might facilitate the assembly of a south polar sequence to complement Pickering's northern one. Bailey left Cambridge for Africa by way of England on November 17, 1908, traveling solo with two telescopes, a camera, and various meteorological equipment in tow. On the advice gained in London from Sir David Gill and Sir William Morris, both veterans of long service to the Royal Observatory at the Cape of Good Hope, Bailey planned to set up a principal station in Hanover. From that base, he could make excursions to test regions of the Orange River Colony, the Transvaal, and Rhodesia. Bailey rode 500 miles from Cape Town on a train that deposited him at Hanover Junction shortly after midnight, then covered the remaining 9 miles wedged into the back seat of a horse-drawn two-wheeled wagon called a Cape Cart. He arrived at the only hotel in Hanover by 2 a.m. The driver opened a door on the porch, lighted a candle, and left me. Bailey chose one of the room's two beds. On the following day, the proprietor and his wife appeared and did all in their power to make my stay comfortable. In a ruled notebook with a blue moiré cover, Bailey graded the transparency of the African sky across a wide area over the course of a year. The amount of clear sky, and especially its distribution throughout the year, he reported, are much more favorable than at Arequipa. On the other hand, the seeing or steadiness of the atmosphere was no better. Moving currents of air often made the stars jiggle in the telescope view. Temperatures rose and fell over a greater range than in Peru. There was more dew to contend with, not to mention the common occurrence of dust storms and violent thunderstorms. The vast stretches of plain, generally known as veldt, are parched and apparently dead in the dry season, but are often green and beautiful in the rainy season, Bailey discovered. Each farm must have its natural spring, fontaine, of water for domestic and farm purposes. Of all the places he surveyed in Africa, Bailey favored Bloemfontein, the capital of the Orange River Colony, as the best site for a permanent observatory. Its sky scored high grades for clarity on his scale, and the area had much to offer in the way of social and educational advantages. While Bailey was abroad, the sky conditions at Arequipa deteriorated further. Smoke issued from the long-dormant El Misti volcano and also the Ubinas volcano erupted, about 40 miles east of the station. As a further aggravation, the condition of Mrs. Draper's finances precipitated a drastic cut in funding. I have recently had to consider very carefully my financial condition and prospects, she wrote to Pickering on January 24, 1909, and find, to my great regret, that I shall be unable to continue to furnish to the observatory the amount I have been giving for the past 23 years for the carrying on of the work of the Henry Draper Memorial. She set August 1st as the date she planned to reduce her monthly support to $400, less than half the accustomed sum. I am exceedingly sorry to have to take this step, which will cause you as much surprise as it does regret to me. Fortunately, I believe that the special work for which I commenced my contribution, namely, cataloging the stars by their spectra, is now in a fairly satisfactory state of completeness. Mrs. Draper's generosity toward stellar spectroscopy had truly honored her husband's name. But its completeness opened new avenues for further work. Just recently, the 11-inch Draper telescope, the same one that furnished Miss Maury with detailed spectra of the bright northern stars, had been turned on fainter stars, opening them to more intense scrutiny and possible refinements in their classification. I have hesitated as long as is wise about making this change, but find now there is no alternative, Mrs. Draper concluded. I am happy that the necessity for reducing the allowance did not arise sooner, and that so much of value has been accomplished. In this, her 70th year, she was appreciating the retrospective view. Pickering, now 62, abandoned all hope of undertaking an expensive transatlantic relocation of the Boyden station. At Mrs. Draper's request, he summarized the results obtained to date with the Henry Draper Fund and projected how it would be used henceforward. He delivered the report in person. Since you were here, I have more carefully looked over the paper, she wrote on February 14th, the anniversary of their alliance, and feel, as I told you, that we had every reason to congratulate ourselves. She regretted that her reduced payments would slow progress, but showed no diminution of her interest in the work or her affection for Pickering. I enjoyed your little visit so very much. It is always a pleasure to hear you talk of what is being accomplished at the observatory. I wish you might run away more frequently. Miss Leavitt's convalescence at her parents' home in Beloit lasted longer than a year. When she finally felt ready to return to work, in January 1910, she was still not strong enough to travel to Cambridge. Pickering agreed to let her work remotely on determining magnitudes for the stars of the North Polar sequence. Under the special circumstances, he sent her a set of glass plates with all the accoutrements she needed: a wooden viewing frame, a magnifying eyepiece, a ledger. She worked only 2 to 3 hours a day at first, but increased her effort as her strength returned. In May, she reappeared at the observatory in good health and boarded again with the family of her uncle Erasmus Darwin Leavitt, the mechanical engineer and inventor who lived in a large house on Garden Street near the observatory. The summer of 1910 brought a cadre of some 20 foreign astronomers to Cambridge. Luminaries included Astronomer Royal Frank Watson Dyson, representing both Edinburgh and Greenwich, Oscar Böcklund from the Pulkovo Observatory in Russia, and Karl Schwarzschild, director of the Astrophysical Observatory at Potsdam, All of them had been invited to the United States by astronomical impresario George Ellery Hale. Hale, now founding director of the Mount Wilson Solar Observatory in California, had helped create the Astronomical and Astrophysical Society of America in 1898, and later conceived a global organization to unite investigators devoted to his own chosen specialty, the sun. The International Union for Cooperation in Solar Research, or the Solar Union, met at Hale's instigation in Oxford, England in 1905 and in Paris in 1907. In preparation for a Pasadena meeting in 1910, Hale hoped to enlist Pickering as a member. The influential Pickering, Hale thought, could help widen the reach of the Solar Union to encompass stars beyond the sun. Furthermore, Pickering, as president of the Astronomical and Astrophysical Society of America, was perfectly positioned to host an East Coast open meeting of that organization, so timed as to bolster foreign attendance at the West Coast Assembly of the Solar Union. Pickering agreed to gather the society's members and overseas guests at Harvard in August, and then chaperone the visitors cross-country by rail for the Union get-together on Mount Wilson. "My adventures began before the train left Boston," Pickering wrote in his travel diary on Saturday, August 20th, 1910. "The porters could not tell me in which car was my drawing room, and in passing from one car to another, I got locked in between them. As the William Pickerings and Professor Bailey waved me a cheerful farewell, they did not know that I was a prisoner alone in a glass cell from which I could not escape." Everyone had benefited from the talks at the three-day Harvard meeting just completed. Six of the distinguished foreign visitors had been elected, at their express request, to membership in the society. All enjoyed the way Pickering interspersed the technical sessions with appropriate diversions, such as the group excursion to the Harvard-affiliated Blue Hill Meteorological Observatory in Milton on Wednesday afternoon, and also the trip to the Witten Observatory at Wellesley College on Thursday. On Friday, mindful of everyone's fatigue, Pickering moved the body only as far as the Harvard students' astronomical laboratory in the yard. Throughout the week, at all hours, his staff had ushered interested visitors to any on-site area they wished to see, from the telescope domes to the astrophotographical library and the brick building. Pickering wrote in his diary that he thought he might sleep for 3 days on the train west. But, in fact, he had a full agenda of important committee work to do en route. Pickering's expertise in photography and photometry allied him with two major European stellar mapping projects, one headquartered in Paris and the other in Groningen. The moment had come for each of these projects to select a standard reference for photographic magnitudes. Pickering wanted to see a single standard applied to both efforts, and he wanted that standard to be the revised Harvard photometry. As chairman of the Committee on Photographic Magnitudes of the Astrographic Chart Conference, the Parisian effort, also known as the Carte du Ciel, Pickering held considerable power. But other photometric standards had been devised, and the issue was to be decided by vote. Harvard's chief competition came from Pickering's fellow committee member, Karl Schwarzschild, who had authored his own Potsdam Standards of Photographic Photometry. As it happened, Schwarzschild was on the train with Pickering. So were committee members Herbert Hall Turner of Oxford and Oskar Backlund of Pulkova, making a quorum. Indeed, the entire contingent of traveling astronomers was conveniently confined to two specially hired rail cars. On Sunday, August 21st, 1910, they reached Niagara, in which no one is disappointed, Pickering wrote. The roar of the falls, interrupted only by astronomical talk. Informal committee meetings whenever I sit still. In the morning, a carriage ride to Goat Island, and the wonderful electric railway from which you see the entire river. In the afternoon, the Maid of the Mist, steamer, not young lady, and an impressive view of the American Falls from its base. The best I have seen. My coat got so wet that I had to keep my back to the sun to dry it. They got to Chicago on Monday, toured the parks and the university physics laboratories, and were joined by several more astronomers when they reboarded the train at nightfall. John Stanley Plaskett of the Dominion Observatory in Ottawa, who made his own record of the trip highlights, relished the way the group traveled across the continent in two special cars and in the 8 days occupied in the journey became almost like a family party. On Tuesday, August 23rd, after a long morning talk with Turner, Pickering called a meeting of the Photographic Magnitudes Committee in his drawing room. Backlund, Schwarzschild, Turner, and I discussed the matter for 2 hours, so busily that we did not find out that it was extremely hot until the meeting was over. Temperature 102 in the shade. The thermometer went down when you put the bulb in your mouth. At an open window, the breeze was hot like that from a furnace. We all suffered, and several ladies were ill. Many of the visiting astronomers were accompanied by their wives, and Harvard's own well-known Mrs. Fleming was also aboard the train. The next day, Wednesday the 24th, Pickering worked all morning to complete his part of the committee report on photographic magnitudes before another rolling meeting convened at 3. This one included an additional member, Edwin Brent Frost of the Yerkes Observatory. Pickering recreated the drama later in his journal in the present tense. "They don't want to come, as the thermometer is nearly 100, and point to Turner, who is asleep. I wake him up and make them all attend the meeting in my drawing room. It is so hot they cannot contribute their portions of the report. As a result of our labors, and heavy labors too, we all agree on a system of photographic magnitudes which will probably be the system of the world. I am repaid for my journey of 2,000 miles, had I done nothing else. Astronomers very kind and complimentary, and Schwarzschild gives up his Potsdam system and accepts that of Harvard. My part in this will be regarded as one of the most important things I have ever done. Thus, the acceptance of the Harvard photometry standard, one of Pickering's top goals for the trip, became a fait accompli before the train crossed the Great Divide. In Flagstaff, Arizona, on Thursday, Percival and Constance Lowell guided the visiting astronomers through the Lowell Observatory, then waved them on to the scenic wonder of the American West. Saturday, August 27th. Walk in morning to another point on the rim of the Grand Canyon. Prepare 6 copies of a 3rd draft of the report on photographic magnitudes with the help of the hotel typewriter. Leave in evening for Pasadena. Pickering, flush with his success at advancing the Harvard photographic standards for photometry, could only hope that the Draper system of stellar classification by spectra would fare as well in the imminent contest for international approval. Over the 5 decades since Father Secchi grouped the stars visually by color and a few spectral lines, classification schemes had proliferated. Harvard alone had produced 2 or 3, depending on how one counted Miss Cannon's modifications of Mrs. Fleming's original Draper catalog. A veritable babble of terminology prevailed. To make himself perfectly clear when addressing other astronomers, Pickering often translated Harvard designations into the simpler Secchi names. Describing one of Miss Cannon's F5G stars, for example, as belonging to Secchi's 2nd class, a spectrum crowded with many lines. Secchi's system, familiar as a Latin grammar, lacked the vocabulary to describe all the spectral distinctions revealed through photography and modern analytic techniques. Astronomers knew they could improve their communications by choosing one classification system to abide by, or else by creating a new hybrid. The issue was due to arise at Mount Wilson, when the Solar Union debated broadening its mandate to include other stars. Wilted from the heat of the Mojave Desert, The astronomers reached Pasadena late Sunday afternoon, August 28, 1910, and checked into the Hotel Maryland. The collegial body that had banded together in Boston, then expanded in Chicago, now melded with West Coast residents and Solar Union delegates newly arrived from as far away as Japan. 87 strong, the attendees represented 13 countries and 50 observatories at the largest gathering of astronomers ever assembled. Monday, August 29th, the fourth anniversary. No doubt Pickering would continue to mark the date of Lizzie's death until the day of his own. This year, he passed the grim occasion in good company, visiting the offices, laboratory, and machine shop of the Mount Wilson Solar Observatory. The facilities occupied a one-story concrete building in town, where Hale joined the group to describe the fabrication of the unique instruments they would see over the next few days on his mountaintop. At the afternoon garden party given by Hale and his wife, Evelina Conklin Hale, the astronomers met some of Pasadena's most influential citizens. It took all of Tuesday to reach the summit of Mount Wilson. A few of the astronomers, though dressed in suits, ties, and derby hats, mounted saddle horses and mules for the ascent. Others chose to walk. Most, including Pickering and Mrs. Fleming, rode up in carriages. Several dangerous turns in the road, at one of which we all had to get out. Road so narrow that there is no chance for teams to pass. Outer wheels within a foot of the edge, and death for a large part of the way. Those who could bear to look down extolled the view of orange groves and vineyards in the valley. At the top, Pickering, hoarse from days of talking and the alkali dust of the desert, retreated to the one-room cottage assigned to him. Living very primitive but comfortable, no appliances for blacking boots, which are always white with dust instead of black. A feather duster is used in this part of the country instead of a blacking brush. My greatest wants are a cow and a bathtub. Water is scarce, and milk much more so, as there is no grass on top and all the fodder must be hauled up the mountain. The recently visited Lowell Observatory, in contrast, had accommodated a dairy cow named Venus. Most topics of discussion at the Solar Union's plenary sessions pertained specifically to the sun, naturally enough, in a mix of English, French, and German. Not until the afternoon of the final day, Friday, did the solar scientists vote, unanimously, in favor of extending their studies to the stars and formally considering the question of stellar classification. A committee of 14 is appointed, and I am made chairman. They kindly say, of course, I rise to express my thanks and ask the members of the committee to remain after we adjourned so that we might begin work at once. A shout of laughter goes up as all have heard of our meeting with the thermometer at 100 degrees. Undaunted, everyone present who had been named to the new committee stayed put, as Pickering requested, and listened to him tell the story of the Henry Draper classification. He described how the letters of its alphabet had strayed from the usual order into Miss Cannon's arrangement, in which each category seemed to define a different stage in the life of a star. Pickering did not press for the system's acceptance. He anticipated many more discussions before the committee, let alone the Solar Union as a whole, reached consensus on classification. For now, he merely wished to acquaint his fellows with the system he knew best, and hear their ideas on how to proceed. The first to speak, Mount Wilson Deputy Director Walter Sidney Adams, testified loudly in favor of the Draper system. The ensuing discussion soon proved that most members shared his good opinion of it. As much to my surprise as to that of the others, Pickering marveled in his diary, practically everyone approved our system, so that instead of an attempt to replace it, it received the strongest endorsement I could have desired. Chapter 9. Miss Leavitt's Relationship. The eastbound train to Boston, lacking any reserved cars for astronomers, afforded Pickering few opportunities for politicking. Nevertheless, he managed to meet briefly between San Francisco and Denver with two members of his new committee on the classification of stellar spectra. Together, they constructed a questionnaire for polling their peers about the pros and cons of the Draper system. Although the full committee favored the Draper classification, some wanted to modify it, a little or a lot, before proposing its formal adoption at the next meeting of the Solar Union, 3 years hence, in Bonn. The beauty of the Draper nomenclature lay in the richness of its data. Harvard's Draper Memorial catalogs comprised more than 30,000 stars, a claim that no other classification could make. The great number of stars falling into the relatively small number of categories affirmed the system's validity. Its level of complexity struck a pleasing compromise between the minimalism of Secchi and the minutiae of Miss Maury. Moreover, it depended entirely upon observable differences, without defending a particular theory. Not theorizing had been a point of honor with Pickering from the outset. By 1910, however, young astrophysicists chafed to embrace theory. The ideal classification system must be rigid enough to guide and support new research, yet fluid enough to contain conflicting ideas about the dynamics, distribution, and evolution of stars. In November, Committee Secretary Frank Schlesinger of the Allegheny Observatory in Pennsylvania sent out the questionnaire he had helped draft on the train. It went to all 15 committee members and about as many non-members selected for their strong interest or expertise in classification. Notably, Annie Cannon, Wilhelmina Fleming, Antonia Maury, and Einar Hertzsprung, the Danish astronomer who had so emphatically endorsed Miss Maury's approach. The questionnaire began with a recapitulation of the committee's impromptu meeting on Mount Wilson at the close of the Solar Union conference. Given the fact that all present had smiled on the Draper classification as the most useful ever proposed, the first question asked, "Do you concur in this opinion? If not, what system do you prefer?" Answers trickling in over the next several months overwhelmingly favored the Draper system, as might have been predicted. Even Hertzsprung endorsed it, though he called for specific improvements in response to question number two. "In any case, what objections to the Draper classification have come to your notice, and what modifications do you suggest?" Here, a few astronomers took aim at the system's alphabetical names. Mundane labels such as B and A, they felt, failed to conjure any helpful images. In contrast, the system fashioned by Norman Lockyer in 1899 applied the name of a typical star in each category to the category as a whole. Procyon, for example, a yellowish star in the Little Dog constellation, defined Lockyer's Procyonian division, a cumbrous but evocative term. Neither Pickering nor Mrs. Fleming had viewed the alphabet letters as permanent fixtures when they introduced them, but rather as neutral symbols, easily replaced with meaningful names once meanings emerged. Even so, years of use had imbued the letters with significance. At Harvard, at least, the mention of A instantly called to mind an alpha star like Altair in the Eagle constellation, with blue-white light and a spectrum of unadulterated hydrogen lines. Among those astronomers content with capital letters, a few regretted the lack of alphabetical order in the Draper system. They thought the progression OBAFGKM looked grotesque or random, as though signifying nothing. Miss Maury roundly rejected it, not simply on aesthetic grounds, but because she had convinced herself the categories, as now arranged, represented the true course of stellar evolution. The overwhelming predominance of types O and B in the nebulous regions of Orion and the Pleiades, she told the committee, proved that stars were born from gaseous nebulae in a blue-white heat. As stars aged, they cooled, faded to white, then yellow, finally ending their days in red senescence. The letters or numbers affixed to each stage, therefore, should reflect the seamless flow of stellar life. Astronomers who shared Miss Morey's evolutionary view commonly spoke of early stars when they meant white ones, and called the red stars late. Those opposed clung to the color words and cautioned against hitching classification to an evolutionary theory. Henry Norris Russell of Princeton, the youngest member of Pickering's committee, envisioned a different evolutionary path from the one Miss Morey described. Russell thought stars might start off red, warm up to yellow or white, and then cool down to red again. He further theorized that stars led different lives depending on their birth weight, and that only the most massive ever achieved the highest temperatures. The Draper classification seems to me all the better because the letters are not in alphabetical order, Russell declared. This helps to keep the novice from thinking that it is based on some theory of evolution. Apparently, the alphabet could flout its own order and still remain effective, or even improve its utility as a labeling scheme. Pickering could see that much on his typewriter's QWERTY keyboard. The third of the questionnaire's five questions contained three parts. Do you think it would be wise for this committee to recommend at this time or in the near future any system of classification for universal adoption? If not, what additional observations or other work do you deem necessary before such recommendations should be made? Would you be willing to take part in this work? The mixed reactions to this question crossed party lines. Some of the most outspoken boosters of the Draper system hesitated to press for its formal adoption, fearing the time not yet ripe. The Draper classification surely surpassed all competition, but perhaps something grander might yet be created in its place. Committee member Edwin Frost of the Yerkes Observatory had long dreamt of a classification system modeled on the ones for plants and animals, dividing the kingdom of the heavens into phyla, classes, genera, and species, all with Latin names. He still hoped astronomers would set that sort of system as a future goal. For the time being, however, Frost thought it foolhardy to tamper with the Draper classification, especially given Pickering's personality. With his habitual courteous consideration for the views of others, Frost warned in his questionnaire response, Director Pickering might adopt those of the suggestions made with some unanimity, and then we should have still another classification to add to the present confusion. Question four concerned a single detail. Do you think it desirable to include in the classification some symbol that would indicate the width of the lines, as was done by Miss Morey in Annals of the Harvard College Observatory, Volume 28? This question, too, elicited oddly divided opinions. Both Miss Cannon and Mrs. Fleming gave a qualified yes. Miss Cannon pointed out that such distinctions applied to only a small fraction of stars studied. Mrs. Fleming welcomed any symbol that would obviate the need for extensive remarks. The open-ended final question asked, "What other criteria for classification would you suggest?" Answers ranged widely. But the most common answer was no answer. When Pickering apprised Mrs. Draper of the growing acclaim for her husband's namesake system, she declared the case a triumph, the well-deserved response to the years of labor the director had devoted to the classification and the thought he had expended upon it. She was happy for him, she said, and happy, too, for the sake of Henry's memory. Miss Cannon felt touched very vitally by the adoption issue. It is a far cry from our own sun to the nearest star, she wrote in a memoir. Yet we know that the stars are suns and that many of them are in exactly the same state of composition as our sun. It is therefore befitting that the Solar Union should be interested in the composition of the heavenly bodies. Though she welcomed their interest, she worried, lest this great international body might adopt one of the several other systems of classification proposed and not adopt ours. Mrs. Fleming had founded the first Draper catalog on thousands of tiny spectra photographed through a prism at the telescope's objective end. Those pictures portrayed the violet end of the spectrum well enough, but captured very little of the red. Now that newer photographic techniques and improved dry plates could cover a wider spectral range, Miss Cannon tested the soundness and durability of the Draper classification by re-examining some of the old stars in new photographs. She took pains to work blind, first classifying the wide new spectra, and only later looking up Mrs. Fleming's designations. It soothed and gratified her to see the overall agreement between them. Apparently, the violet end of the spectrum sufficed to settle a star's identity. Miss Cannon corrected some of the original classifications, but more often she just enhanced them with the added spectral detail at her disposal, such as changing an F star to an F5G. Mrs. Fleming helped revise the ever-improving Draper catalog by revisiting the numerous spectra formerly lumped in the peculiar category. The pace of her variable star discoveries remained slow as she hastened the delivery of Annals volumes to the printer. That winter, she found only 8. Early in 1911, however, in recognition of her cumulative record, the Sociedad Astronómica de México awarded her its Guadalupe Almendaro gold medal for her prowess among the variables. The Bruce medal still eluded her, but she hardly lacked for recognition from her fellow members of the Astronomical and Astrophysical Society of America, or the fans who had made her an honorary member of the Royal Astronomical Society and the Société Astronomique de France. Mrs. Fleming so often visited Professor Sarah Whiting's classes at Wellesley as a guest lecturer that the college had named her its honorary fellow in astronomy. She was anticipating giving another talk at Wellesley, scheduled for late May, when the fatigue that had dogged her all spring turned to malaise. She elected to enter a hospital for rest. But once there, her condition worsened and she developed a fatal pneumonia. Edward Fleming, now the chief metallurgist for a large copper company in Chile, could not get to Boston in time to see his mother before she died on May 21, 1911. She was 54 years old and had devoted 30 of her years to the observatory. "I have just this moment, to my very deep regret, seen in Science a notice of Mrs. Fleming's death," Henry Norris Russell wrote to Pickering from Princeton on June 2nd. "I cannot do less than write at once to express my sympathy for the loss that I know will be felt very deeply and in many ways by all the circle at the Harvard Observatory, and by a far wider one of friends outside." The youthful Russell had spent some time with Mrs. Fleming at meetings in Cambridge and on the previous summer's trek to Pasadena for the Solar Union. "Her loss will be a severe one to science, and must be a terrible blow to her friends," he commiserated. "I did not know the son of whom she spoke so often, and so can hardly send a message to him. But the sense of loss on hearing that she is gone was so keen that it seemed natural to write to you." Pickering's eulogy for Mrs. Fleming in the Harvard Graduates magazine retold parts of the saga she had shared with him over the years about her ancestors. The Claverhouse Fighting Grahams, how her great-grandmother had eloped with Captain Walker of the 79th Highlanders, followed him to Spain in the Peninsular War, then given birth to a son on the Corunna battlefield the very day the captain was killed in combat. Surely the family medal had stiffened Mrs. Fleming's spine. As her longtime supervisor, Pickering could aver, it was only necessary to tell her exactly what was needed, and she saw that it was carried through successfully in every detail. After enumerating her many astronomical discoveries and distinctions, he said she formed a striking example of a woman who attained success in the higher paths of science without in any way losing the gifts and charm so characteristic of her sex. Miss Cannon had written the obituary notice for Mrs. Fleming that Henry Norris Russell read in Science, as well as another longer one for the Astrophysical Journal. The articles gave her occasion to praise her late friends, naturally clear and brilliant mind, her extremely magnetic personality, and that quality of human sympathy which is sometimes lacking among women engaged in scientific pursuits. Miss Cannon also took pains to describe the rare collection of glass plates entrusted to Mrs. Fleming's reliable care. Each photographic plate may be likened to the only existing copy of a valuable book, and being very fragile, must be safely stored, and at the same time must be accessible so as to be consulted readily at any moment. It seemed right that Miss Cannon should succeed Mrs. Fleming as the official curator of astronomical photographs. Pickering raised the idea in October 1911 with Harvard's new president, Abbot Lawrence Lowell, brother of Percival Lowell, who took office after Charles Eliot retired in 1909. Not only had Miss Cannon fulfilled the duties of curator since Mrs. Fleming's passing, Pickering said, but she had done so in a very satisfactory manner. Moreover, he added by way of endorsement, Miss Cannon is the leading authority on the classification of stellar spectra, and perhaps on variable stars. Lowell reacted negatively. I always felt that Mrs. Fleming's position was somewhat anomalous, he replied on October 11th, and that it would be better not to make a regular practice of treating her successors in the same way. He therefore declined to recommend that the Harvard Corporation appoint Miss Cannon. Instead, he suggested, Pickering should install her himself, as a matter of ordinary department business, with less fuss, lower pay, and no cause to cite her name in the university catalog. The members of the visiting committee were appalled. It is an anomaly, their 1911 report said of the slight to Miss Cannon, that though she is recognized the world over as the greatest living expert in this line of work, and her services to the observatory are so important, yet she holds no official position in the university. Miss Cannon did not let the denial of university title stand in the way of duty. In October 1911, she embarked on new projects to unify and strengthen the Draper system. She reclassified Miss Morey's bright northern stars to conform their Roman numerals to the current Draper designations. She took up Mrs. Fleming's unfinished last catalog of faint southern stars and brought its 1,688 listings into alignment. Both her speed and her certainty in judgment had increased, as too had her love for the work. She thought she might as well keep going, examine more plates, continue classifying indefinitely, expand the Draper catalog exponentially. Pickering's volunteer army of variable star observers blanketed the Northeast by 1911 and extended as far west as California. There was even an outlier in Australia. Faculty and students at New England colleges such as Amherst, Vassar, and Mount Holyoke participated energetically in the routine observations. Strong foreign support arrived monthly from amateurs in the variable star section of the British Astronomical Association. Harvard's own professional staff still led the charge, with Leon Campbell alone averaging 1,000 observations per month through a 24-inch reflector. Campbell's attentions shifted in the spring of 1911, when Pickering sent him to Arequipa as director of the Boyden Station. The new post positioned Campbell to keep vigil over the long-neglected long-period variables of the southern sky, but also forced his abandonment of the northern ones. To fill Campbell's vacancy, Pickering called on the Corps of Volunteers. He drew up a list of 374 variables requiring frequent surveillance and assigned each star to one or more regular observers. He also circulated the list as an invitation for others to participate. Given the interruptions to be expected from inclement weather, moonlight, and personal engagements, one star could never have too many pairs of eyes on it. He prepared printed forms to facilitate the filing of reports, provided finder charts to help new recruits locate their stars, and promised to publish the volunteers' observations. Hoping to head off any needless duplication of effort, Pickering urged his troops to communicate among themselves and cooperate wherever possible, such as by observing at different times of the month and different hours of the night. Popular astronomy editor Herbert C. Wilson saw the need for an even higher order of organization among variable stargazers. In the August-September 1911 issue of the magazine, Wilson entreated his readers, "Can we not have in America an association of observers with a variable star section, a Jupiter section, etc.?" In an almost instant reply, lawyer and avid amateur observer William Tyler Alcott of Norwich, Connecticut, announced the October formation of the American Association of Variable Star Observers, AAVSO. Alcott had caught the variable star fever from Pickering at a public lecture the director gave in 1909. The two corresponded afterward, and Pickering, recognizing Alcott's dedication, arranged for Leon Campbell to coach him at his Connecticut home. The founding of the AAVSO cemented the already close ties between Alcott and Harvard. Professor Anne Sewell Young of Mount Holyoke, one of Pickering's most reliable regulars, immediately signed up as a charter member of Alcott's association. In December 1911, her recent observations formed part of the AAVSO's first published report in the pages of Popular Astronomy. Soon, Sarah Frances Whiting and her assistant, Leah Allen of the Wellesley College Observatory, joined the AAVSO. And also Mariah Mitchell's successor at Vassar, Caroline Furness. The group welcomed devotees from any sort of day job. Charles Y. McAteer, for example, worked as a locomotive engineer for the Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, Chicago, and St. Louis Railway Company. At the end of the night freight run into Pittsburgh, he would go home to the 3-inch telescope in his backyard and observe variables till dawn. The AAVSO members concentrated on the variables of long period. Most such stars waxed and waned gradually through as many as 9 magnitudes of change in the course of a few months to a year plus. They were always on their way up or down the brightness scale, filling hours with quiet purpose for Pickering's minions. The short period variables, on the other hand, defied tracking by telescope. Within days, within hours in some cases, they suddenly flashed, then faded. The rest of the time, they stayed quiescent at their lowest ranges. One needed great good luck or a series of photographic snapshots to glimpse their brief brightening. Just such a series of pictures taken within 2 to 3 days of each other in 1905 had alerted Miss Leavitt to the untold number of quick-change stars in the Magellanic clouds. Miss Leavitt had been called home again to Wisconsin after her father died on March 4th, 1911, and she spent the spring and summer helping her mother settle Reverend Leavitt's small estate. Back in Cambridge in the fall, she found the observatory family still adjusting to the loss of Mrs. Fleming. Miss Cannon was supervising the computers. Mabel Gill, a staff member since 1892, had taken over the preparation of several annals volumes